You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 30th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, live. In studio, Matt Taibbi on the triple effing American citizens are getting from Wall Street, specifically their pensions in this case. But we'll talk more as the show progresses. Also on the program today, we are exactly 11 hours and 59 minutes from the government shutdown that Republicans welcome, as John Culberson of Texas said, like 9/11, let's roll!
Unbelievable.
New report out says the Yemeni leaks on the Al-Qaeda plot far more damaging to our national security than anything Edward Snowden released. The Department of Justice suing North Carolina over their draconian attempts, I guess, to disenfranchise voters. Also, abstinence only in Texas seems to be failing, so they double down on it. And I'd also like to find out who their webmaster is. Apparently, they pay a lot of money for websites in Texas. More on global warming and Obamacare. The exchanges open 2 minutes after the government will shut down. Apparently, that is non-discretionary spending, so sorry, Tea Party. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Matt Taibbi will be live in studio. You can head to majority.fm to see the live show, or you can pick up the app and watch it live on your phone, both your Android or your iOS device. We'll be back in just a second. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome live in studio. I think this is actually our first non-Friday, casual Friday in studio guest, Mr. Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone magazine. Hello, Matt.
What's going on, Sam?
We've done this many times, but never in a studio.
How
this...
could you have deprived me of the opportunity to come visit
place? You're the first real guest. I mean, I don't want to say real guest, but our first weekday guest, I would say, to come into studio. You know, it's you've watched just how my sort of context have just shrunken and gotten more haphazard, right? I mean,
it's as Bill Belichick would say, it is what it is.
Yes, yeah. It is what it is. Matt, incidentally, has been using hand sanitizer from the moment he got into the. Okay, all right.
The antibiotics are what I've been using here, actually. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about this. You got a big piece in Rolling Stone magazine, the September issue, looting the pension funds. You have worked in part with David Sirota, who did a report for the Institute on America's Future on more or less the same topic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with who John Arnold is.
So John Arnold used to work for Enron. He was an energy commodities trader. Have you seen the movie?
The smartest guys in the room.
Alex Gibney's Oscar-winning documentary. Remember that whole part where they were rigging energy prices in California and talking about
Grandma Millie,
and we're gonna jam $250 a megawatt hour right up her bleeping bleep. And these guys were, you know, they were intentionally shutting down power to one place so that they could jack up the power, the rates in another place, et cetera, et cetera. John Arnold was one of those guys. Basically, he came from that wing of the company. In the book, he was quoted by Bethany McLean, you know, the author of The Smartest Guys in the Room, is talking about how he was proud of the people in that unit for their ability to use the quote-unquote Enron bat to move around prices.
Nice.
So this is a professional, like, price manipulator, basically. When Enron went bust, he took $8 million as a bonus out of the company in its fading days right before the pension fund went bust.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you, right? Later was censured by our judge for doing that, along with a bunch of other executives.
That censure must have really hurt.
Yeah, oh, I'm sure it hurt, because he immediately went from there and became the world's most successful commodities energy trading hedge fund. He started a fund called Centaurus. They all have names like that, these like bloodthirsty medieval names. Made himself $3 to $4 billion. And now his ambition is to be kind of like the new Koch brothers, and his pet issue is pensions. And what he's been doing is going around the country and funding pension, quote unquote, pension reform candidates. And his whole thing is that state and municipal pension funds should be moved into a kind of a 401k style system. Workers should take massive cuts. And this is the key part that most people don't understand all that well, is that this hybridized, this new 401k style plan, they have to go after higher returns by investing heavily in what they call alternative investments, meaning hedge funds and private equity and stuff like that. So this is essentially what he wants to do is basically George Bush's Social Security privatization, but at the state level.
So what we're talking about here is the agenda is move government workers, public workers, and because this has been ongoing, and the project is nearly complete in the private sector, move them from defined benefit programs where a worker knows what they're going to get at the end of their retirement. And it's up to the people who manage the fund to make sure that they've funded it enough to pay for that.
Right.
This is basically just a contract. You know, I'm going to defer my pay. And it's going to be cheaper for you as an employer to deal with that, because you're going to collect interest on whatever vehicle you use.
Right.
To a defined contribution, which means we know each month how much I've got to pay into this thing, but we don't know what's going to come out the other side. And by privatizing it, we're talking about all sorts of fees. So this this chapter of the story starts at least in a sort of, I guess, the canary in the coal mine is Rhode Island. Tell us what happened in Rhode Island.
So Rhode Island is a really interesting test case. They have a Democratic treasurer there, a Rhodes Scholar, Harvard and Yale educated, woman named Gina Raimondo, who is very impressive in person. She is talked about in New England as someone who has not just gubernatorial ambitions, but possibly national aspirations as well. She's very bright, and she's kind of been chosen to lead pension reform efforts in Rhode Island. They obviously have a huge unfunded liability crisis there, like a lot of states. And she did a couple of things that were new and innovative in that state. One was that she enacted a pension reform plan that cut benefits and moved them to this 401k, at least hybridized 401k style plan, but did so without negotiating with the unions. So that was new. That had never been done before, sort of unilaterally changing contracts. They did this initially a couple of years ago. Then they were forced by the courts to abandon that because it's unconstitutional, not just nationally, but on the state level. They went back. They negotiated with the unions this time, and they got a slightly better deal. The unions did. But in doing so, they essentially moved, they got Rhode Island's workers to take a pretty healthy cut, you know, 14-15% across the board cut. And then they also moved these funds, you know, they went from 0% invested in hedge funds to 15% invested in hedge funds in the entire state. Alternative investments total, if you include private equity and venture capital, they went up to like 25, pushing 30%. So you have, it's a small state. I mean, its fund is like $7.5 billion, but you're talking like $1.5 billion. That they put into hedge funds. And, you know, so that was the really interesting thing, is that first was this attempt to kind of unilaterally impose pension reform, which had kind of never been done before. And then the other thing was this massive immediate expansion of alternative investments.
And I want to talk about sort of the crisis that is here that sort of sets the table for this, makes it sound somewhat reasonable that reform is necessary. But before we get there, let's talk about these alternative and innovative investments. Mm-hmm. And the implications of them. One, they're inherently risky.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever seen a hedge fund prospectus?
I don't know that I qualify to be able to. But all I know from hedge funds are what I learned from Octopus, that Guy Lawson book. But tell us about the sort of the nature of these as risky investments. And then let's talk about the fees involved.
Right. So, just to follow up on that, you pick up any hedge fund prospectus, one of the first things you'll see is a big disclaimer on the front that says in big letters, these are high-risk investments and you may lose your entire allocation, or you may lose everything, essentially. So it's not the first thing you would think of if you were going to, you know, be putting billions of dollars of public money into that, you know. I
mean, that's basically like you're going into a roulette table,
right?
And that's all right, no problem. I've got all of the state pension funds here with me,
right? And hedge funds, you know, they're a corner of the financial universe that are more or less totally unregulated. They're funds that are limited to sophisticated high net worth individuals or institutions. You know, an ordinary person can't just go invest in a hedge fund. It doesn't work that way. You have to be a certain kind of investor who's got a lot of money, a very high roller. It's kind of like the VIP room of high finance.
Right.
And theoretically, you know, sometimes these funds turn incredible profits because they have unique strategies. I mean, they're not like mutual funds or S&P index funds where you're just rising and falling with the economy. These guys make bets. I mean, they will do aggressive positions in one direction or another. So you might end up with 40, 50, 60% returns for a single year, as opposed to, you know, the 6 or 7%, you know, boring returns you're going to get just with the stock market. But it's a very opaque, shadowy corner of the financial universe where you get very little information about what's going on, and then the fees are just outrageous. I mean,
Tell us. I mean, relative to I mean, let's say just going to buy an index fund.
Right.
What kind of money are we talking about? I mean, particularly in Rhode Island, we're talking about a very specific number.
Right. Well, let's back up and talk about how much these things cost. So the price on Wall Street of everything is measured in what they call basis points. So a basis point is 1/100th of a percent. Right. The typical fee for a hedge fund, the main fees are a formula that they call 2 and 20, which means you get 2% just for showing up. So if you invest $100 million with me, I get $2 million just because you did that, just because you picked me. Then I get 20% of whatever profits I make on your money.
So it's basically a retainer and then 20% on your profits.
Right. And it works out to be total. It works out to be about 3% typically, if you're making any money. A 2% fee would be 200 basis points. You can take a basic index fund. Like I talked to the guy who worked for the state of Rhode Island, and he invests a lot of the state's money in a standard S&P 500 index fund where you're just betting on the entire stock market.
Right.
And he says that on the low end, he pays 0.875 of one basis point. So he's paying less than 1/100th of a percent for a fee for that kind of investment. So a hedge fund might be 200 or 300 times as expensive as an ordinary index investment fund. And they, as it happens lately, they've been underperforming those funds. Very famously, 5 years ago, Warren Buffett bet a bunch of cocky hedge fund guys here in Manhattan that if I just made a basic, bet on every number on the roulette table kind of bet on the stock market, an index bet, I'll outperform you guys at the end of 10 years. Five years into that bet, Buffett's beating the cleverest hedge funds in Manhattan by about 8.5 points percent.
Wow.
So you're paying, 100, 200, 300 times, and you might be making less.
And in the case of Rhode Island, we're talking the difference between millions and tens of thousands.
They just announced last week, Raimondo announced last week, that the fees so far for alternative investments for last year are $70 million. Now, it's a $7 billion fund overall, so that's already 1% of
the
entire fund. It's projected that number is going to rise a little bit, so it'll probably end up being $80 to $85 million in fees. Now, what's interesting about that is that number pretty much matches what they asked workers to give back in cuts. So one of the things they did is they froze the cost of living adjustments for cops, teachers, firemen. Every year they were getting a little bit of a bump in their pensions.
Oh, that's disgusting.
So yeah, well, right, yeah. How could that be tolerated?
You're going,
right?
That's absolutely. You need to get that money into the hands of hedge fund guys immediately.
Immediately, yeah. How is that overlooked all these years, right?
That's stunning. So you're saying that for the history of Rhode Island, they've been giving cost of living increases to teachers and firefighters and policemen, and not giving millions of dollars to hedge fund guys?
Think of the injustice of that, like how long that went on.
I can't believe it. That's stunning that people allowed for that to happen. Now, under what circumstances did she announce what the fees were? Because apparently now this is something that state governments are realizing they want to keep very, very opaque.
Oh, yeah. Well, initially she didn't give any information out about it. That the first time that she was even asked about this was when this out-of-town ex-SEC lawyer named Ted Seidel, who writes a blog for Forbes, and he's kind of a national maven on these issues. He went through Rhode Island's books and disclosures, and he wrote a column basically saying, I think they're vastly understating Rhode Island's fees. And when she was asked about it, she just said, I don't have to answer that question. This is private proprietary information.
How does she justify that what the state is paying in terms of fees is proprietary information?
Well, it's what's even crazier about that is that, some of the people who are asking were the pensioners themselves. This is their money. Right. You know, I mean, obviously part of it is the taxpayers' money, but most of the money in the fund is the workers' own contributions.
But I take even exception with that distinction, because the fact of the matter is that taxpayers pay teachers. When the teachers are due their salary, it's not my money.
Right.
It's their money. Any more so than, like, you know, when the guy at McDonald's is like getting his check and I go, hey, that's my money. No, it's not my money.
Right.
It's not my money anymore. I pay the government for services. They pay people for their labor. If they're due that money, it's their money.
Right. Right.
You know, I mean, that distinction. Is it taxpayers' money? No. Taxpayers pay money for a service. We get that service. If part of it is paid to labor for their labor, it's their money. It's the labor's money. And so this is where we go into this notion of unfunded pensions. We're told that we have been so generous with these teachers and these firefighters and these social workers and these government bureaucrats. They're all living high on the hog because, you know, we've been so generous because the unions have just beat up. And that's why they're underfunded. But none of that is true. It's all a lie.
Yeah. Yeah. That was probably to me the most surprising part of this whole thing, because I didn't understand any of this stuff. Every year, you know, most states. Have a mandated what they call an ARC, an annual required contribution. So
before we even get to that, let's go to ERISA. Let's talk about ERISA, because this was a problem back in the 70s where workers would go and they would make a deal with their company. And the deal was the company says, you get pay X. Instead of pay X, we're going to give you X minus 1%.
Mm-hmm.
But if you wait 30 years, you're going to get plus 3% or 4%, because we're going to take that money. It's going to be cheaper for us than giving you 1%, because we're going to put in 0.5%. But over the years, it's going to accrue. And so you're going to end up getting more pay than you would if we give it to you now, and you'll have a retirement. That's what a defined benefit program was.
Mm-hmm.
But we found out that what these companies were doing is they were promising to put that money away, and they weren't doing it. So ERISA comes into the picture. Tell us about ERISA.
So It's exactly as you described. It was designed to prevent exactly the kinds of abuses you were talking about. It was a federal law passed in, was it 1971, 72, something like that?
Early
70s. Yeah, something like that. But there's a loophole in it. Amazingly, they just forgot to put state and municipal pension funds under the purview of ERISA. So, and, you know, I talked to one union leader during this time, and he was saying the government basically just never countenanced the idea, the concept, that the state would rip off its own workers. They just didn't think that there would ever be an interest in doing that. And so the states were never included in this law. And but that shouldn't matter, because even so, even without ERISA, it's still mandated by state law in almost every state that you have to make this regular contribution. If you make a deal, you know, you collectively bargain a deal with your workers, and they put in contribution X, and the taxpayer has to put in, you know, a little bit of extra. That's your ARC. That's your contribution. That's mandated. You have to do it. But what's been happening in a lot of states, dating back decades, is that politicians have just been like not making that payment, and then they go and spend the money on other stuff. You know, they give out tax breaks to buddies. That's Rhode Island is like the worst case scenario for that. If you look at Rhode Island's books, you'll see hundreds of development loans given out to local cronies that are never paid back. You know, it's some like councilman's brother who wants to build a restaurant in some place, and they give him $400,000 and he doesn't even pay back, you know, the interest on it, you know, decades later. It's that stuff. They don't pay the pension contribution, and then they use that money essentially just to pay, you know, graft. And this has been going on systematically in at least 14 states. And that's a major reason that these funds are underfunded, is because if you're making your payments year after year, they would even have been all right during the, you know, post 2008, during the crash. But when you don't make your contributions, everybody knows. I mean, it doesn't matter how high the returns are.
And in some respects, that dynamic is similar to what happened with Social Security.
It's exactly the same.
We're going to borrow funds from essentially the pension fund, and then we're going to say the pension fund doesn't have anything but IOUs in it,
right?
Essentially,
right? Yeah.
And so it's just pieces of paper in a filing cabinet. What percentage, when they develop the ARC, what percentage do they anticipate? In other words, how do they calculate what they're supposed to put in? We're going to put in X number of dollars because we're assuming a rate of return,
right?
That is Y. And at the end of 30 years, it's going to provide this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how they come up with it, but I do know that they calculate it based on what the expected payout is supposed to be. I mean, they assume a rate of return for the market, you know, over long periods of time. That's really key. It's not, you know, over the next 3 years,
right?
It's, you know, historically over 4 years, if we do this every single year, we're going to get X amount of dollars, and that's going to be enough to make up the rest.
So it could be somewhere around 6%, 7%, something
right.
like that. Something that's not terribly aggressive,
right?
But is saying that we're going to grow this, and that's why everybody's getting a deal here,
right? And it's just enough that it's really helpful to politicians who want to reach into the kitty. It's not, you know, watched by a gazillion think tanks and you know, journalists. They're not looking at, it's not like the budget that everybody's staring at. This is a pension fund. It's kind of it's a black box that nobody really knows what's going on with it. If you just don't pay the ARCs, nobody's going to notice, except for the treasurer.
Yeah, but don't the unions sort of, like, don't the unions have somebody in their union, or somebody that, you know, represents all of the public unions, saying, like, your job is to make sure,
yes,
that the pension's being funded properly.
Yeah, and this is a major problem. Typically, these funds have at least a couple of union reps on the board, but there's no requirement that anybody on the board have any financial expertise. Typically, so you very, very often the people who are sitting on these boards have no idea what's going on. I talked to one guy who was hilarious. He's a firefighter in Providence. He's like, "You ever been to one of these bleeping meetings?" And I'm like, "No." And he goes, "Man, it's like the movie Wind Talkers. You know, like, you can sit there and listen to it for a half an hour and have no idea what the hell they're saying. You know, like, and it's hard. It's hard stuff. I mean, you know, like, this kind of finance is difficult. And especially when the stock market is hot, like it was in the 90s and, you know, the earlier part of the last decade. What they were often told was, well, we don't have to put in the whole amount this year because look at the returns we're getting.
Right.
You know, I mean, we expected to get X this year. If we, you know, we're already getting that, putting in 40% of the contribution. So,
and the problem with that is that you are not looking at the reason why they do this over a 30-year period, because for every year that you're going to get, the 25% returns,
right,
there's going to be a year where you get no returns or maybe some losses.
Right,
and,
yeah, there's going to be a 2008 for every 1997, you know?
And so we have this situation where you've got these hedge funds are starting to move in. And but before you even get there, there's also another aspect to this about the underfunded pensions. And that is where you quote Dean Baker in your piece, where he basically says, not only is there a situation where some of these states underfund their pensions because they would rather provide tax cuts for wealthy or tax expenditures for, you know, former Red Sox pitchers.
Right, exactly.
Who, you know, think they have like a trading card?
A video game company.
$75 million down the tubes. But if they had just invested this in a way that was not risky or driven by other people's fees, mm-hmm, there'd be no problem. Just expand on that.
Okay, so, well, I've been covering this crash era for 5 years now, right? What the single biggest scam that happened in the last 5 years was big banks selling toxic, fraudulent mortgage-backed securities to institutional investors, meaning very often pension funds, state pension funds. So you had a whole bunch of hotshots from, you know, Goldman, Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, whatever, and they descend upon some state where you have a state, you know, a state employee or a state board that's not terribly literate, typically hires a middleman consultant that's friendly to the bank, and the bank says, you need to have a certain percentage of AAA rated stuff in your fund, because that's typically true. The fund requires that you have, you know, X amount of AAA. And we're going to sell you these AAA rated mortgage-backed securities, which will earn you a much higher rate of return than treasuries or whatever else, you know, you think you can buy. That's AAA. And so all of these funds all over America put billions and billions and billions of dollars. They bought billions of dollars worth of this stuff. And it all blew up.
And parenthetically, when they say you got to get your AAA, these mortgage-backed securities, and then parenthetically, what we call back in the office, huge steaming piles of shit.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And the banks knew this stuff was crap. They knew that these mortgages were fraudulent. They knew the math was bad. They knew they were paying off the ratings agencies to give them AAA ratings. I mean, there were like nine different ways moments on the road to that AAA rating where this whole thing was wrong, and the banks knew about it. I mean, they funded the whole operation. They'd give money to a Countrywide. They'd tell them to go out in the neighborhoods, give a loan to everybody with a pulse.
Right.
Then they'd buy those loans back. They'd stir them up into a pot. They'd buy off some ratings agency. They'd give it a AAA rating, and then who would they sell it to? This is who they would sell it to.
The dumb money. I mean, that's basically what we heard from Wall Street when this plan to float to privatize Social Security was floated, and that is, we want to get our hands on that dumb money.
Exactly.
And because they're going to take that money and they're going to put it in products that gives them high fees, and in some instances that they're going to bet against.
Right.
So that they can make money both ends of the deal.
Coming and going. Yeah, exactly.
And so this money goes into those crappy investments. Of course, it crashes and debilitates. And Dean Baker has done the numbers, and essentially,
that's it. The non-funding of the contributions and the crappy mortgage-backed securities pretty much is your entire fiscal pension crisis. Actually, it goes beyond. Like, you know, the Pew Center estimate about how underfunded the states are. I think it's what, $760 billion over.
Yep.
Well, Baker's numbers are they're down 930 over the same period of time, just because of those two factors, because of losses in 2008 and because of the underfunded contributions.
I think he even says at one point that even taking into account the underfunding that's going on, if they had just been in 30-year treasury bonds,
right,
then public pension assets would be $850 billion richer, this is you writing, than they were 2 years after the crash.
Right.
And he reported that states with a were short an additional $80 billion over the same period, thanks to the fact of the post-crash cash-strapped states had been paying out that much less of their mandatory ARCs payments. So there was a compounding.
Right.
The crisis also made the states short of revenue that was coming in for taxes, and so they paid even less than their
contributions.
Their contributions, and so let's talk about Pew, because when we hear Pew, we think
polls.
We think polls, and we think
journalism,
think tank,
yeah,
and journalism, and no agenda here, and
right.
Like just about everything that seems to exist now in this country, these guys have been bought and paid for.
Right. They have some kind of relationship with Arnold that goes back.
This is the former Enron guy.
About two years ago, they started engaging in partnership efforts in the States. Pew was frequently invited in as a consultant by states to look at state's pension finances, and they would
because
come
they're out, trusted.
They're trusted. They're considered a centrist organization. They put out this study that's called the Widening Gap, which is all about unfunded liabilities, and it's considered like the Bible of pension finance. Like this is where you look to see what the numbers are on states' pensions and how much they are owed, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so they were invited in by states like Kentucky and Rhode Island. Also did a lot of work with Pew, and then they'll come out with these pronouncements. You know, here's our 6-step plan for how to get out of it. And it turns out it's exactly the same plan that Arnold has. It's the same plan that Gina Raimondo in Providence had, which is put it into a 401k style thing, make the workers take a hit, and then alternative investments, because you got to jack up the returns. That's the most important thing. And, you know, and this is the formula that they're looking for. And to me, and if you put all these things together, it's basically just a wealth transfer. It's just like, here's a bunch of money. We're gonna gin up a whole bunch of panic about a fiscal crisis, and people are gonna lose services if we don't do something about these spiraling pension costs. And so we're gonna cut the benefits over here, and then we're gonna move all that dumb money into our, you know, management
fee
by our
generating, head. Right. Yeah. It's something that's going to basically allow us to buy more. We're going to have control this huge amount of money that's going to just generate us more and more fees.
Right.
And the upshot, too, if you run a hedge fund, is you don't pay any taxes. You don't pay
carried interest
on there. And so you get a tax break on it.
Right.
As far as I can tell, really the lesson of this is everybody should be a hedge fund guy.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been covering hedge funds for a while, and I learned stuff about this business and how great it is that I never knew. You know, when I was looking at the different fees that you pay, that a state would pay, there's stuff I never knew existed. Like, I knew about 2-20. You know, I knew you get 2% for showing up. I knew you get a share of the profits. And sometimes it's higher than 20. You know, Stevie Cohen of SAC Capital, remember him?
Uh-huh.
He used to charge 3-50, which is kind of like getting a, you know, when you pay for a massage, if it's $100, it's probably a massage. If it's $500, it's probably more than a massage.
Right.
Yes. You know, when you get charging 50% for the profits, there's, you know, probably some insider trading going on. But beyond that, they also get trading fees. And this doesn't show up in the state line budgets, because all they're doing is just returning you less money. So every time they make a trade, they take out.
So you actually have to go into their reports.
Exactly.
To see exactly, because they're not charging you fees. They're taking a cut.
Right.
So you, before you even see those returns, they've already taken their piece.
Right.
So that never shows up. That's
so in other words, if they make a trade that earns $100, they might return to the fund $97. Right. But you won't see.
They've already picked up their $3.
Right. Exactly. But that's not even it. There's more. They have this something called fund expenses, which I never knew existed, which I guess can be just about anything. It can pay for lunches and travel and all kinds of other stuff. And this can be as much as 0.5% of the entire deal. So you can be paying 50 basis points. Remember that the entire S&P index fund that Illinois is paying for is 1 basis point. So this other fund expense fee can be 50, which is crazy. And then there's another fee that you pay if you want to redeem these funds. If you want to take money out, it's kind of like an IRA, you know, when the government charges you to, you know, with taxes to
right.
take the money out, they take another little bit out. So by the time you add up all these fees, it can turn into 4 or 5 or even 6% of the entire nut. And if you think about the numbers that are involved, you know, these are massive, massive allocations.
All right. So here's the big question is, and part of it is answered in, just in the second paragraph of your piece, when you're talking to the president of the Providence Firefighters Union, and I'll do this quote, but make a note here, Michael. Paul Dotti says, speaking of the Rhodes Scholar Gina Raimondo, who is the treasurer in Rhode Island, she's Yale, Harvard, Oxford. She worked on Wall Street, says Dottie. Nobody wanted to be the first to raise his hand and admit he didn't know what the fuck she was talking about. and this is, I mean, there's only two answers here as to why what's going on. One is that most of your state officials, when you get into this world that even regulators, even the best of regulators, are it's murky for them.
Oh, yeah.
When you're a state official and you're simply told by somebody from Wall Street, look, here's my bona fides, here's my CV, here's my past record of past performance, who knows how legit that is even, you got to put your money with me. You've got salesmen coming to you who have the bona fides, who have the respect in the in our society because of who they are, and they're either doing one of two things. They're hoodwinking state officials, or they're getting kickbacks.
Right, right.
I mean, that's basically it, right? Or
yeah.
both.
Yeah.
And the kickbacks can come in the form of just like, why don't you join me at this charity gala or
right.
whatever it is? You're going to be a member of the community, or here's $200,000 for your next campaign.
Right.
Any number of things.
Let's look at the example of Rhode Island, right? So Raimondo is rumored to be running for governor. She's already raised $2 million for a gubernatorial run. I mean, think about the size of Rhode Island. I mean, that would be a healthy, you know, for an undeclared candidate, that would be a good Senate kitty.
Yes.
Think about it,
yeah.
right? A large percentage of that money is from out of state. A lot of it's from companies like Bain and Goldman and their typical, all the Wall Street characters. In addition to that, there was a 501c4 organization there called Engage Rhode Island, which is, you know, in the post-Citizens Rhode Island universe, Citizens United universe. Nobody knew exactly who was behind it, but they were spending an enormous amount of money to promote Raimondo's pension reform. Now, it came out this summer that Arnold had contributed at least six figures to that fund. They spent about $800,000 to promote her her plans. And so, you know, look, pensions are a perfect way to gather tribute for political purposes because you can give away enormous amounts of money. I mean, you think about it. They gave away Raimondo, you know, they hired just three hedge funds that were involved with the Manhattan Institute, and those guys got allocated $200 million total to play around with. Yeah. And, you know, these guys turned around, they gave her an award. You know, the Manhattan Institute made her Innovator of the Year.
I bet.
And then all of a sudden her campaign kitty is full of money and, you know, full of Wall Street donors. And it's a loophole in the system. Let's just put it that way.
Is there anybody who's, I mean, okay, so you have essentially Arnold and Pugh walking around, going around, as almost like Alec in some respects. Mm-hmm. And chose Rhode Island as, this is going to be the model. We've got a Democratic treasurer here, so there's going to be absolutely no headwind when we start to spread this across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine Arnold has contributed quite a bit to the Pew Foundation.
I would imagine. I heard numbers, but I wasn't able to confirm them. So
there you go. We can all just imagine what that number could be. Is there any... do they have any obstacles here?
Well, the unions,
right?
You know, but they and the unions, I think, have begun to catch on nationally to what's going on. And I think the first thing that they thought about was, well, who exactly are we investing in? You know, they started to notice that some of the funds that were being hired by states were supporting like anti-labor foundations that were campaigning against defined benefit plans. So you think about it, you take it, you know, here's some hedge fund that's getting hired and it's taking $100 million of state union money. And that same guy is going to turn around and campaign against labor, you know, positions. You're essentially asking union workers to fund their own disenfranchisement,
right?
Which is crazy, and I think they started to pick up on this.
So first, it was a political thing, and then as they dug into this, they started to realize there's some very practical implications.
Yeah.
This.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That, you know, not only are we being demonized as the cause of every state in the country's fiscal crisis, you know, undeservedly in many cases, but you know we're paying these enormous fees to the very people who caused our funds to get in trouble in the first place. And so it's like a triple whammy, you know. And in A, you lose all the money in the crash because your state treasurer was too stupid or too corrupt to avoid buying these awful products from Wall Street. So you've lost your retirement savings. Then they invest the fund in, with some guy who wants to take more of your benefits away. And then you find out that you've hired that guy, that the rest of your money is going to pay his fees, that, you know, so you're taking a cut.
You're funding your own demonization as you start to whittle down.
I mean, think about it. I met these guys, you know, the firemen, they're making pension payments, $20,000 a year, $22,000 a year, something like that, right? And healthcare, right? And they're turning around and then they're paying billionaires with their cuts. I mean, they're turning around and they're saying, we're willing to sacrifice because we know our state's in trouble. But it turns out that the sacrifice is going straight into the pockets of these guys. And it's just so unconscionable on so many levels.
The piece is looting the pension funds. It's in, we will link to it on the site. We'll also link to Sirota's study of this. And hopefully in the coming years, we'll start to see the unions sort of take on this issue and become more sensitive to how they're getting screwed. And, you know, this is all just part of the whole project of, I mean, the amazing thing is on one hand, we have state workers who are allowing this screwing to go on, who are also sort of facing demonization just because they work for a government.
Right.
Also now because of state workers are going to be feeling the implications of what's going on in Washington because they lose funds as well. And so they're furloughing people. They're firing people. It is just an incredible onslaught that's going on. And, you know, 3 years ago, I got hired to do some comedy show with Janine at the Aspen Idea Festival.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was just a disaster. But one of the things was we were supposed to do a talk show, and Grover Norquist was one of the guests.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I thought it was going to be sort of this light jocular, you know, mocking our own. The guy said over and over again, like, Grover, what's going on? He's like, government workers are the cause of, and I was like, what? Like, it was a complete non sequitur. And I said, Grover, there's no cameras here. We're not on TV. And he just, for the entire show.
He's like Robert De Niro. He was in character all the time.
Robert De Niro. He was like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man.
Right.
It was just over and over again. Government workers, government workers, government workers. It was, and I just walked away from that. I said, something's going on here.
Right.
And this has been the long-term project. All right, well, listen, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. I know you only got a couple of minutes to hang out, but I want to play this segment of Alex Perrine on CNBC sort of piercing the bubble of insanity that these guys live in on CNBC. It is incredibly instructive. I know you haven't seen it yet. We're going to watch it live and comment on it right after we take a break and head into the better half of the show. 646-257-3920. We'll start to take your calls. I'll fire up the IM machine. We'll take your IMs. Matt's going to stick with us for another couple of minutes. And we're going to go over this. We'll be back in just a minute. Don't forget, you can become a member today at majority.fm. If you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. Full disclosure. If that is your habit to buy through Amazon, why not buy it through our link? Go to our link at majority.fm. Click on it, bookmark it. Always buy your stuff there. You'll notice no difference. We will upgrade our facilities here. We actually have them a dedicated mic for Matt today. We have two cameras, folks. First time ever. We're going to a two-camera shot. If the cutting sucks, blame Matt. Not Matt Taibbi, Matt, producer Matt.
We got to get a green room in here, though.
I know. Maybe we'll just paint a section of the...
Like a corner right there.
Just like a shower stall.
Step into a little booth.
With some Ritz crackers.
Exactly.
Makeup's in the bathroom.
Folks, become a member today. We will spend 70 cents of every the first dollar we get from you on buying Ritz crackers and cheese for our next guest. JustCoffee.co-op, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. We'll be back in just a moment.